Before I start, I want to say thanks, not just for a really good conference, but for many years that I have to thank Hugh for. And those of you who know Hugh and those of you who know me will see quite clearly how much of what I'm going to say today actually comes from Hugh, either directly or indirectly. So, of course, he's not to be blamed for any of the mistakes, but I really owe him a whole lot in more ways than I can count. So thank you, Hugh, for that. Okay, so since the work of Kripke, Lewis, and others ushered in the modal revolution in analytic philosophy, concepts of necessity and possibility have been at the forefront of the sort of collective philosophical mind. Modal facts concern what is possibly or necessarily the case. These contrast with what are sometimes called categorical facts, which concern what is only what is actually the case. So modal notions, including concepts of conceptual, metaphysical, and gnomic necessity and the counterfactual conditional, are central to philosophical theorizing in every area of philosophy, from the foundations of logic to moral theory. I'm a philosopher of science, and modality enters science with notions like cause, natural law, probability, dispositions, and capacities. So, for example, consider laws. Laws are related to regularities in the pattern of actual fact. They have to be if we were to use information about regularities to form beliefs about laws, and information about laws to predict actual events. But they have implications that outrun their implications for what actually happens. To say that L is a law is to say more than that things actually happen in accord with L. It's to say that they must happen that way, that they couldn't happen otherwise. And that's just a point about the logic of law talk. Okay. Or consider chance. Facts about chance are related to the pattern of categorical facts. Again, they have to be if we're to use information about categorical facts to form beliefs about chances, and information about the chances to guide expectations or beliefs about categorical facts. But chances have implications that outrun their implications for what actually happens. And again, this is just a remark about the content or the logic of beliefs about chance. To say that a certain type of event, a coin flip coming up heads, for example, or an atom decaying within a given time frame, to say that that sort of event has a good chance of occurring is to say both more and less than that it will occur on a given occasion, or even occur with a certain frequency in a class of actual cases. It is to say something about the expected frequencies in hypothetical cases. Okay. Now, in both these cases, in cases of law and chance, there is an ineliminable modal component to the content of these claims that distinguishes them from any mere claim about how things actually are. These sorts of claims have implication not just for the way things are, also have implications for the way things are in non-actual possible worlds. Similar things can be said about other notions that have an important role in science. Causes, for example, are famously connected to counterfactuals. The same goes for capacities and dispositions. There is no way of giving truth conditions for claims about these structures, again, just as a claim about their content, without adverting to counterfactual implications. Okay. Now, modality, as you saw from James's paper yesterday, is a kind of sticking point for a lot of empiricists. Some of them, for example, James, recognize the commitment to science comes with a heavy dose of modal commitment, and I accept that entirely. There's a whole slew of beliefs, not only about how things actually are, but how they might have been, could have been, would have been had they been otherwise. Okay. And a lot of people accept modality on the strength of their commitment to science. Science cares less about the pattern of actual events than what those patterns reveal about the modal substructure behind the phenomena. But others, for example, von Frossen, as again James brought out quite nicely, shun talk about modality on the grounds that this talk of non-actual possibilities, if it's not veiled talk about actuality, must be nonsense. So again, just to quote, bring up one of the quotes that James showed us, von Frossen takes the rejection of modality to be one of the defining features of empiricism, as he says. To be an empiricist is to withhold belief in anything that goes beyond the actual observable phenomena. That's the more famous part of his definition. But also to recognize no objective modality in nature. Sorry. So understanding modality is a matter of some urgency for philosophers of science. There are different ways of trying to elucidate modal notions. One can try to give an analysis that doesn't use modal vocabulary. There's a long, famously long tradition of trying to do this. There are good reasons, I think, for thinking that that discussion has run its course and that no informative analysis of modal concepts in non-modal terms is possible. Barring that, one can shed, at least if analysis is understood in terms of giving truth conditions. Barring that, one can shed some light on modality by clarifying its formal and logical properties and its inferential and analytic connections to other notions. A lot of really good work has been done on this, on modal concepts. But one can also do more than that. One can turn her attention to a kind of side-on view of the role that modal beliefs play in our cognitive lives. And by our cognitive lives, I mean our epistemic and our practical reasoning. She can ask how modal beliefs are formed and put to use, why creatures with our concerns and interests develop the capacity for modal thought. What does it do for us? What benefits accrue to the practice of modalizing? Now, I like Boris Kmet's way of putting this. He says, before we start to philosophize about modality, we have an implicit theory about it. The philosopher provides this pre-philosophical system of beliefs with the foundation and refines and extends and corrects it from within. She acts as a participant in the practice of modalizing. That is, her standpoint is internal to this practice. But the philosopher should also make the practice of modalizing itself an object of study. She should, as it were, take a standpoint external to the practice in order to describe the practice and explain what its function is, why it exists. Now, I want to do something like that for the central modal concepts of science, except I deny what Kmet is saying here in calling this an external standpoint, because it will itself use modal concepts. So I want to explicitly deny the possibility of really stepping outside the practice, as it were, as though we could really describe or conceptualize or come to understand the practice without using modal notions. But the idea is rather to take a side-on view of the practice in which these concepts arise, of a kind that is internal to the fully articulated scientific picture of the world. Not only is this, I think, the right methodology for a naturalistic philosopher to adopt, but it's one that holds rich rewards for self-understanding, and indeed any sort of fully articulated scientific picture of the world is going to have to include in its scope an account of the very practice of arriving at a scientific world picture, including the full slew of modal commitments that goes along with that. So this process of filling in the part of the scientific vision of the world that takes our epistemic interaction with the world, right, as a subject matter is one that Sellars emphasized and that Shimoni has described as closing the circle. Okay. So I'm going to talk of the modal content of models rather than modal beliefs, because this is a much more natural mode of representation in science. I'm going to look at how these kinds of modalized notions like chance and law and the other ones like dispositions, capacities, and so on relate to the pattern of actual fact. I'm going to focus on the two that I mentioned at the outset, laws and chance, because they're the most familiar and we have the most sort of straightforward understanding of the logic of these notions, though I think it does generalize to notions like dispositions and capacities and a whole bunch of kind of modalized notions that are part of the heart of scientific theorizing. So let's consider laws. The most fundamental laws have the form of differential equations that give the rate of change for a quantity at a point. They entail the existence of regularities, but they can't be reduced to regularities, again, because the very notion of law recognizes the possibility of regularities that are not laws. Consider chance. These are represented by a real-valued function over space-time. They're related to frequencies by a number of theorems of different strengths, the weak and strong laws of large numbers and Bernoulli's theorem. But again, as with laws, they can't be reduced to frequencies, because even the strongest of the theorems relating chance and frequency explicitly allows for the possibility of chances that diverge arbitrarily far, albeit with diminishing probability, from the chances. Okay. So I take these facts about laws and chance to show that they're representative of a class of structures that I'm just going to coin the name intermediate structures for. These structures are typically locally defined, but they bear necessary connections to distributed structures or patterns in the manifold of categorical fact. We might say that they encode information about such patterns, and that information is drawn out in the kinds of empirical inferences in which they figure. So a convenient way to picture this is that there's a sort of ground level of categorical fact, and then there's a kind of second-order overlay of modalized structures like laws and chance that play a role in guiding expectation and interaction with the world and guiding belief and expectations about patterns in the manifold of actual fact. Okay. That's just a functional remark so far. And it's tempting to suppose that these structures on the second-order modalized overlay, are just redescriptions of lower-level patterns, so to speak, compact summaries of information about the pattern of actual fact. And a lot of people have tried to understand them as exactly that. Functionally, it's easy to see why we might find these kinds of locally defined quantities that contain veiled information about distributed patterns useful, because it's useful to build information about the way things generally hang together, to use again a phrase of Sellars, into our descriptions of the here and now. In general, we build a lot of useful but extrinsic information into our local representations of things, and this information can be unpacked to guide prediction and interaction with those things. So when I describe someone in a perfectly mundane way as a wife, a mother, and a physician, that's not an intrinsic description. It carries a lot of extrinsic information about the world, about her place in it, about her habits. And that information comes with a slew of expectations that guides my interactions with her. Okay? And that's a general sort of cognitive strategy. That's one of the reasons that we represent. But we've already seen why no reduction is possible. That is why no reduction of these sort of structures on the second-order modalized overlay to simple redescriptions of patterns in the manifold of actual fact. These structures fail the logical test for identity with lower-level patterns. There's a logical gap between claims about law and claims about regularity. There's a logical gap between claims about frequency and claims about chance. here's the argument in brief, and here I'm just summarizing, you know, I think what's a much longer argument that needs to be made, but just it's an argument that I would defend and to indicate the kind of direction in which it would go, at least the first couple of steps in the argument. Make any stipulation you like about what the laws are, and that stipulate, and I should say, I think the person who's made this most clearly and articulately in literature is Tim Maudlin. Make any stipulation you like about what the laws are, and that stipulation will have models in which there are exceptionless regularities that are not laws. Okay? Or make any stipulation you like about what the chances are, and that stipulation will have models in which the chances diverge arbitrarily far from the frequencies. And the same goes for dispositions, capacities, and causes. Now, Humeans in the tradition of Lewis, and you know, Maudlin's discussion is explicitly are aimed at sort of the descendants of Lewis, have tried to finesse this by combining stipulations about all of these, about laws and chances and other sorts of modalized categories, into a single package, and then to try for a more holistic reduction. But I think the difficulty remains. Make any stipulation you like about what the laws and chances are and whatever else you want to put into that package. And there's going to be models of the chance plus law package that contain exceptionless regularities that are not laws and frequencies that diverge arbitrarily far from the chances. Again, so I just want to emphasize there's a kind of modal gap in our understanding of the contents of those notions that remains however you try to analyze them in terms of facts about the actual pattern of categorical fact. A bit redundant. So there's an inelimitable looseness of fit between structures on this sort of second-order overlay and patterns in the manifold of categorical fact, a difference in truth conditions. Information about the pattern of actual fact can provide evidence for claims about law and chance, but the relationship between them falls short of identity. So now you might scratch your head and say, but what does that mean exactly? I mean, since the difference in truth conditions can only be made out itself in modal terms, it's really an empty difference if all meaningful claims about modality bottoms out in implications for actuality. Right? I think it's sort of really hard to understand what that modal gap amounts to. And I think here the really telling arguments against the Humean view, the view that ultimately you can kind of understand that modal gap itself as an empty one, emerges clearly when we adopt a side-on view. Okay. The logical gap is connected to the function of these notions. No non-modal counterpart of these notions, that is, no non-modal extensional analog, no mere description of patterns in the manifold of actual fact, could play the role that modalized notions play in guiding belief and action. Okay. Let's start with the wide-angle view of why we construct models of the world at all. Okay. And notice what I'm trying to say is that the modal content of our models is important here. It's important and irreducible to any kind of description of patterns in the manifold of fact, of categorical fact. And here I don't just mean the relatively esoteric, when I talk about models, I don't just mean the relatively esoteric products of professional science. I mean the internal world models that the brain makes to help us navigate a complex and changing terrain. I take science to be just kind of continuous with project that we do kind of individually and necessarily in building models of the world. We are the only creatures who seem to have evolved to use models as a setting for an explicit form of practical reasoning, or at least to do it with anything like the power and the sophistication that we do. There's evidence that mice and other creatures do a rudimentary form of map keeping, but we have full-blown models of the world on which we represent ourselves and our ends, our behavior, or rather our deliberate behavior, not, for example, the beating of our hearts, but the willfully initiated movements of our limbs, is governed by a decision process that involves explicitly representing potential actions, imaginatively tracing out their effects, and making a choice based on projected outcomes. This process is our most powerful cognitive tool, and one that gives us our primary advantage over other kinds of naturally evolved cognitive systems. Models provide the setting for this deliberative process. Now, the added layer of kind of representational mediation between stimulus and response gives us a kind of flexibility and foresight that holds perhaps our greatest advantage over our natural competitors. So functionally, constructing models is a human strategy for behavior management, and a specifically human strategy for behavior management. Science is an extension of this basic strategy, involving the collectivization and systematization of information, construction of models of varying scope, different models for different contexts. We construct maps of space, models of atoms, cells, and ecosystems, and these models all play a role in our interaction with the natural environment. In this capacity, model construction is not merely a matter of copying, and a lot of you will recognize this as an adaptation of a quote from Rorty. It involves restructuring, reorganizing, transforming, and reconfiguring. It involves gathering, storing, integrating, and transforming information collected, combining it, transforming it, reformatting it in ways to make certain kinds of tasks easier. Models are tools. Their job is to facilitate interaction between an embodied agent and an open environment. I like to think of them as a kind of practical and epistemic interface between a mind characterized by certain kinds of limitations, right, and a quickly changing environment. Some of the structures defined on the model have the job of representing, tracking, or mirroring localized elements in the landscape. In those cases, the account of use will support the kinds of localized correspondences that most people think of as paradigmatic of representation. It seems natural to expect this kind of localized extensional correspondence, for example, between representations of local matters, a particular fact in a first-order model, and something in the world, like a lightning strike or the decay of a radioactive atom. But that's actually a quite specialized function. There are other kinds of function, other kinds of representation that encode information about more distributed structures, beliefs about trends and currencies, the latest fashions, the value of a dollar, the state of the union. And other kinds of representations are there to facilitate, or other kinds of structures defined on a model, are there to facilitate computation. We store information about dates and locations in formats that make it easy to compute duration and distance. And in general, information will be encoded in different formats to facilitate different kinds of function, different kinds of epistemic and practical tasks. The lesson here is that models provide embedding frameworks for phenomena that package information for useful application in situ. And this repackaging can introduce a holistic restructuring that doesn't generally preserve piecemeal correspondence. Okay, so far, so good. Chance is easy to understand in these terms. Chances guide expectation in open-ended classes of systems. It doesn't correspond to actual frequencies because actual frequencies can be skewed in a way that would make it unsuitable, that would make them unsuitable for that role. If a coin falls heads half the time, but all of those head tosses occur before the first birth of Socrates and after the year 5011, supposing someone is around tossing coins at that time, it would be stupid to take even odds on heads or tails. Chances reflect facts about stable relative frequencies over the short term in a way that's quite precisely designed to allow them to play the role that they do in guiding expectation. I'm gesturing towards a lot of quite complicated structure that's involved in the notion of chance here. Structure that needs to be there in order for them to play the role that they play in guiding inferences over the short term. The epistemic uses of models have to do with carrying information. And so far, I've just talked about the epistemic uses of models. And those uses have to do with carrying information, computing, predicting. But those aren't the only uses that models have. Models also guide our interactions. And the ways in which we represent things will contain implicit directions to action. To an agent, the world is chock full of opportunities and affordances. And the terms in which she represents the world will be designed to disclose those opportunities and affordances. They'll contain conditional invitations to action. To represent ice cream as delicious is to represent it as eat-worthy if one is hungry. to represent cheating. As wrong and tigers as dangerous is to warn us away from both if we don't want to be censored or injured. There are more complex conditional practical imperatives built into causal beliefs. A map of causal pathways highlights potential strategies for achieving ends in a way that's made most explicit, I think, in the interventionist analysis of the notion of cause. Now, recognizing the practical dimension of use, that is, the use of models not just to represent or guide belief, but its use in guiding action, is just what I think we need to understand what are sometimes called deolithic modalities. These are the sorts of modalities that concern not just how things might actually be given what we already know, but how things would be had they been otherwise. So the explicitly counterfactual supporting modalities. These are notions that concern specifically counterfactual possibilities. And I said about I said that saying that A follows B is not merely regularity, even an exceptionist regularity, but a law, means not just that A failing to follow B doesn't happen, but that it couldn't. This extramodal force can only be made out in counterfactual terms. And this sort of extramodal force has always seemed problematic. It adds nothing to our beliefs about the pattern of actual fact. What does the modal force add? Well, it doesn't have an effect on opinions about what actually happens, but it does add something of practical importance, right? Something that makes a difference to choice. You might try to bring out about an exception to a regularity, but you wouldn't want to try to bring about an exception to a law, or at least you oughtn't, and that's part of what it means to say that it's a law. It would be a waste of time, a strategic mistake. The same goes for a difference between causes and correlations. And this has been a topic of a good deal of discussion that Hugh pointed to this morning, since Russell pointed out that causal information is not reducible to information about laws of temporal evolution. To say that the association between A and B is not merely a correlation but a cause adds some counterfactual force. It supports the inference that if one were to bring about A, B would follow. This doesn't add anything to our beliefs about what does happen, but it does add that one could use the link strategically, manipulating A to bring B about. So again, it adds something of practical importance. The specifically counterfactual implications of belief about laws and causes play a crucial role in practical reasoning. Should I accept the Queen's Gambit or defend my knight? Should I buy the red shirt or the blue one? Should I take the beaten path or the road less traveled? That depends on what would happen if I did. There's no way of eliminating that modal content. Only some of the hypothetical futures that I consider in the course of deliberation under the guise of potential actions will be actualized. The others are and will remain strictly counterfactual. Models of all kinds, from the formal products of our deepest science to the maps and artifacts that serve as models in everyday life, to the internal models generated by the mind, sometimes consciously and sometimes unconsciously, serve as both epistemic and practical tools. And the eolithic modalities, the specifically counterfactual content of a model, right, have a practical role. The second-order overlay of intermediate structures guides, in some cases, belief, and in some cases, action. Now, this conception of representation is very different from the conception of representation as reproduction. First, because it's transformative rather than conservative. The goal is quite specifically to repackage information in a matter that has built-in epistemic and practical imperatives, built-in action and belief-guiding force. And second, because it has practical as well as epistemic functions. It doesn't merely help us predict, but also forestall, avoid, call forth, and redirect events. Looking back now, I think we see why attempts at reduction of these structures on the second-order modalized overlay fail. In both cases, the looseness of fit between categorical facts, local matters of particular actual fact, and the structures on the second order modal overlay is essential to the function of those structures. Claims about chances have implications that outrun any finite list of facts about actual frequencies because they have the function of guiding expectations in open-ended classes of systems. Claims about laws have specifically counterfactual implications because they have the function of guiding decision, and decision always needs reconsideration of hypothetical, non-actual possibilities. And I think this conclusion generalizes to other kinds of intermediate structures, causes, dispositions, capacities, statistical probabilities. I like to think of models using a notion that I borrow from Edwin Hutchins and that he takes, I think, from computer scientists in a slightly different capacity, as partially prepared solutions to frequently encountered problems. There's no usable acronym that I can find. They package information in a form that facilitates application in tasks that we expect to encounter. They're like the palettes that a painter prepares before he begins to paint, the various powders and gels that a dentist keeps in his cabinet to be mixed into cement or impression material when the context or occasion demands, or the various utensils in your drawer shaped and ready to perform whisk, cut, spoon, and crush. Viewing models as partially prepared solutions to frequently encountered problems gives us a much more nuanced differentiation of structures corresponding to the array of possible uses that I described. In the cases of models, our tasks are predict, compute, intervene, and there are various ways in which structures can facilitate those tasks. It also captures the fact that the shape that our tools have depends in detail, and this is something that Hugh has emphasized, on both the tasks for which they are fashioned and the capacities of their users. We have epistemic and practical limitations that set the task for cognition. Thinking of models as partially prepared solutions to frequently encountered problems is also a good antidote to the temptation to reify the modalized structures on the second order overlay of the manifold of actual fact, to see them as requiring substantial commitment to truth makers behind, above, alongside the categorical facts. It makes room for all of the variety of different things that we do with models, recognizing extensional correspondence with where they are called for, with the degree of strictness that's demanded by use, but recognizing that some structures have different roles. Viewing models as partially prepared solutions to frequently encountered problems sets the agenda, I think, for interpretation of a wide class of modalized structures that are of central importance in science. And doing so without, again, succumbing to this sort of temptation to reify those structures. It fits very naturally with a lot of work that's been done on chance and law, on laws. I found it very useful to think about causal structure in these terms. Dispositions and capacities are easily accommodated, I think, within this framework. So again, that's sort of a program, a research program for philosophy of science. Okay. Oh, I got way behind here. Okay. Now, this sort of naturalistic account of representational activity comes very naturally to philosophers accustomed to viewing the human organism in naturalistic terms, and seeing cognition, including the fully developed products of our best collective cognitive enterprises, that is, science in general and physics in particular, as a strategy for managing behavior, fine-tuning our responses to the environment. But there's also a tradition in analytic metaphysics that starts with different questions. And here I have a recent but entirely characteristic statement of the metaphysical question. I assume that there are truths involving modal qualification. If modality is grounded in reality, it is either a primitive or a non-primitive feature of reality. If it is primitive, then there is nothing non-modal in virtue of which reality possesses modal characteristics. There are no non-modal facts that wholly constitute modal facts. If it is not primitive, then there is something non-modal in virtue of which modality is present in reality. There are non-modal facts that wholly constitute the modal facts. And once you've set things up in these terms, you're off and running to sort of the kind of representationalist metaphysics that we all know and love. Now, there's a presumption built into this approach that there is something illuminating to say about intermediate structures that doesn't include the agent as a third term. Again, there's, you know, there's reality on the one hand and the model on the other, and we're looking for something in reality, for something in the model to correspond to. That is what gives us this reduced menu of options, primitivism, reduction, or barring that, some form of anti-realism. And again, Hugh has very nicely teased these presumptions out of the standard menu of options in the metaphysics literature. In those terms, I think Hugh was absolutely right about this. There's really nothing very illuminating to say. We can't reduce the modal content of a belief about laws or chances to non-modal beliefs, nor can we imagine it away. So it seems we've got to add it in at the fundamental level if you're thinking in these terms, either in the form of primitive modal facts alongside the categorical ones, or maybe possible worlds alongside the actual to serve as truth makers for modal claims. But look, you know, if it's illumination that we're really looking for here, we should trade the question, what do modal beliefs refer to, or what do models of possible worlds stand for the question, what do modal beliefs do? And it's not that there isn't an answer to the question. It's not that there isn't an answer to the question, what do modal beliefs represent? For me, it was the great insight. I mean, I should say I was educated into this sort of metaphysical tradition, the search for truth makers, and it was a great insight, I think, in the form of deflationary realism that that I learned, at least from Hugh, has been developed, that he's been developing over years, and that I think, if I understood properly, that Bob was defending yesterday in application to modal beliefs, that the answer is unilluminating. So it's not that there isn't anything that modal beliefs represent. Modal beliefs represent modal facts, and counterfactual beliefs represent counterfactual facts, just as aesthetic beliefs represent aesthetic facts. Beliefs about colors represent color facts, and beliefs about cows represent cow facts. Okay. From the top down, all of these beliefs look the same. Formally, they behave truth conditionally. They serve as belief contents, enter into inferences. I can see no reason now to deny them truth values or to adopt anything less than a full-blooded realism about modal beliefs that doesn't... I can see no reason to adopt anything less than a full-blooded modal realism about modal beliefs that doesn't depend on what Bob was calling yesterday a very Procrustean view about how beliefs relate to the world. One that I would add can only be maintained by ignoring pretty much everything that we've learned in the last 30 or 40 years from the study of cognition, and in particular from the movement on situated cognition. That's just not the way that cognition and representation works. The sorts of differences that people have tried to draw in the past between beliefs that genuinely refer or correspond to parts of the world will not be drawn or should not be drawn in semantic terms, but they will appear from the side on. There, when we look in naturalistic terms at the side on, from the side-on view at the role that these different kinds of beliefs play in our interaction with the environment, we will see the difference between beliefs that have the job of feature detectors from those that facilitate computation and those that guide action. The kinds of distinctions that we want to draw between beliefs and that have traditionally been drawn in terms of differences between those that genuinely refer and those that don't, right, will emerge in the account of use. So do we need to supplement our catalog of the contents of reality as it appears sub specie eternitatis with something aside from all of the local matters of particular actual fact that we think of as constituting the history of our world? Something to play the role of truth makers for modal beliefs? Of course not. And it's a side-on view of the practices in which those beliefs arise, their role guiding belief and action in situated agents characterized by certain quite specific epistemic and practical limitations. Right? It's their role in that enterprise that will tell us whether or not we need to, you know, we need something in the world as it appears sub specie eternitatis for those to refer to. And as Price has emphasized this morning and in lots of other places, it's not just that we can't give an account of the role that those kinds of beliefs play without adverting to anything that's visible sub specie eternitatis as truth makers. But it's very hard to see how such structures It's very hard to see how anything that was part of the fabric of reality, as it appears sub specie aeternitatis, could play the role that these structures play in our epistemic and practical lives. Okay. There are different ways to bring that out. In particular cases, it's most familiar in the form of that old complaint about Lewis-style possible worlds. If there were such things, why would beliefs about them guide action in the actual world? In the case of chances, we could say, why would a measure over sets of possible worlds have any role in guiding our beliefs about the actual world? Okay. Now, pragmatism has been around for a long time, but it's been traditionally contrasted with realism, often associated with operationalism. But pragmatism, as I'm understanding it here, and I think if I properly understood what Bob was saying yesterday in suggesting that we should be empirical realists but transcendental idealists about modality, pragmatism in these terms is more of a methodological stance than a philosophical doctrine. In trying to understand the structures that define a model, pragmatists don't look for static correspondences between model and world as it appears sub specie aeternitatis. They reintroduce the agent as a third term, mediating the relationship between agent and world, between model and world, and resituate models in the dynamics of interaction by looking at their role in transforming belief and behavior. That is, see them as interfaces between a situated agent and a quickly changing environment. Modeling is not a matter of mirroring. It involves actively arranging and rearranging information into packages tailored to solve certain kinds of problems, designed to facilitate practical and epistemic inferences. Understanding which structures have practical and theoretical importance for us requires understanding the epistemic context in which they are used. It requires an understanding of our epistemic and practical needs, the kinds of problems that we encounter, the kinds of informational resources we have to address them. These are the structures that find applicability and practical purpose in a context. Nothing short of a full account of the coupled interaction in which they are deployed will be enough in general to relate model to world. Certainly no picture of simple piecemeal static correspondences that eliminates the agent as a third term between world on the one hand and model on the other. Now, the pragmatist doesn't deny, again, that modal beliefs represent. She rejects the representationalist idea of what representation amounts to, or at least she separates it from the thinner deflationary notion of representation that just describes the internal form of truth-bearing discourse, from the idea that when we're looking to understand what X's are, laws, probabilities, or causes, for example, we're always looking for something in the impersonal, mind-independent structure of reality for X's to correspond to. She denies that we're always bound to find such correspondences because she recognizes that a good part of the practical point of representation is to parse information into useful action and belief guiding packages. Okay. So one of the methodological consequences of this sort of reorientation of questions is that when we come to a certain kind of question, questions about laws, causes, chances, or all of the modalized structures on the second order overlay of the manifold of fact that I've suggested are important to science, it's not the bottom-up view of physics or the top-down view of a priori metaphysics that's going to provide the right standpoint from which to gain illumination, but strangely, the side-on view of the cognitive and human sciences that provides a naturalistic alternative to sort of neo-scholastic metaphysics. Instead of a science-independent standpoint from which to do metaphysics, we should look rather for an ecology of concepts. To understand why our concepts have the shape they do, we need to understand the environment in which they're born and used, the forces that shape their growth, the contingent forces that shape their growth. They find applicability and practical purpose in a context. Epistemic practices like prediction and inference make sense, for example, only under the conditions characterized by certain kinds of epistemic asymmetries. And the specific character of those practices requires understanding the epistemic context in which they're deployed, the problems that they're introduced to solve, the tasks that they're introduced to perform. For the philosophy of science, this sort of programmatic view that I'm recommending here just opens up the space for detailed examination of particular cases in a way that's rather liberating, I think. And I've done this kind of thing for chances and causation. It's a recasting of terms that get rid of some of the old ways of asking these questions. Okay. So in sum, truth conditionally, what distinguishes a law from a regularity or a causal connection from a correlation can only be made out in counterfactual terms. If it doesn't have an effect on one's opinions about what actually happens, what does the modal force add? We can say something about descriptions of non-actual possible worlds, but there won't be much more illuminating to say in truth conditional terms. But if we ask what do these counterfactual beliefs do, we do have a very illuminating story to tell. And that's what I think sort of recognizing the practical dimension of use of models does for us. There's an action-guiding component that can't be characterized otherwise than by containing their role, than by characterizing their role in decision. Same goes for epistemic modalities. What does the modal content of a claim about chances add to a claim about frequencies? A belief-guiding component that can't be characterized otherwise than by characterizing their role in the formation of expectation and open-ended classes of systems. And what's important about that is that characterizing their role in either epistemic or either in expectation or decision requires, again, reintroducing the agent as a third term into the relationship between model and world, with all of the asymmetries, accidental and otherwise, that characterize her cognitive situation. That's an unaccustomed and important methodological departure, even for naturalistic metaphysics, which has tended to see itself as, you know, in some contexts of naturalistic metaphysics, people have thought what we should be doing here is just taking our metaphysics over wholesale from physics. And I'm suggesting that's not quite the right thing to do. We've got to reintroduce the agent and start looking at the role of beliefs, even beliefs about things like fundamental laws, in the role that they play in the kind of cognitive life of the embedded agent. So again, just that's pretty much all I have to say. And I just wanted to say that, you know, a lot of the detail for this stuff comes and can be found in Hugh's books, as everybody here knows.
Saying that the thing is a law doesn't have any strictly empirical consequences that the mere regularity doesn't already have. So we're not adding more empirical content. So the empirical thing is just contained in regularity. In saying that this is a law, we are in effect saying this is what I'm going to use in my decision making in this way. The thing I feel paradoxical is that it seems as if it's then a bit arbitrary which of the regularity I pick this one to use in my decision, someone else picks another one. That's not itself empirically controlled. And that seems somehow counterintuitive, because we think after all the one I pick is going to have somehow consequences, because it's going to, as you say yourself, it affects what I choose, and therefore it affects whether life goes well for me or not. And that is a kind of, isn't that a kind of empirical result. So it somehow matters.
Well, when you're
which one? So can't we say, look, if somebody picks one regularity, someone else picks another, and things go well for this guy, not for that one, there's somehow a kind of a, I know this is all very arm-waving, empirical reason, you know, to think, well, the first way of picking, you know, there are strategies for choosing which are the laws, and there's the good ones and the bad ones, and we think that the good ones could be give us choices of what to regard as laws, which will be such that when we make decisions on that basis, things will go well for us.
Let me contrast
two different sorts of viewpoints. First, I mean, the claim about the difference between, you know, sort of beliefs about regularities and beliefs about laws. That was just a claim about content. I want to make it very sort of as starkly as I could the point that, well, look, you know, no mere description of regularities could play the cognitive role that beliefs about laws do because they have this modal force. And then the question is, well, what is this modal force? And that's the point at which you sort of look at the role that modal beliefs play in the cognitive life of the agent. So, you know, there are two different sorts of standpoints that one can have. One can try to take a kind of survey of the contents of reality as they appear sub specie aeternitatis, or one can adopt the viewpoint of the embedded agent. From the viewpoint of the embedded agent, I want to say that, of course, the right psychological attitude is full-blooded realism about you know, all of your modal beliefs. And when you're talking about modal beliefs, you're the beliefs that you form, the content of those beliefs, what those beliefs are about, really is to be understood in sort of deflationary terms as beliefs about counterfactual possibilities. And what you're doing when you're running through a decision procedure is, first of all, you know, for the reasons that Hugh said, and I think, you know, that those could be further elaborated, you cannot but view your action from your point of view in the context of deliberation as something that's unresolved, unsettled, literally remains to be decided. And everything that hinges kind of downstream from, you know, everything in the future that sort of hinges on the result of your decision process itself is as open as the decision process. So I think there really are kind of unrealized possibilities for you from the embedded perspective. And the question, you know, the role that you know, so your beliefs about hypothetical possibilities and hypothetical futures for yourself, your attitude should be completely realistic about those. You can also step back and see, you know, ask what role, ask, you know, sort of what do modal beliefs, how should we see modal beliefs sub specie aeternitatis from the, you know, as kind of part of the net. And there I think the right thing is, well, beliefs about, you know, what's possible and what's necessary and modal beliefs in general, right, appear in the world from that point of view as part of the natural history of deliberating agents. And when you see the role that they play in the kind of cognitive and epistemic lives of deliberating agents, you also see that they don't refer or correspond. So there's not, you know, to anything sort of, as it were, outside the head. You see that they play this kind of role in helping us, you know, sort of decide how to act and in forming beliefs about how the future will go and so on.
Sorry, just a quick answer. I'm not completely satisfied. I guess my point is that I'm nothing against the realism. You know,
yeah.
I wouldn't suggest any people backing away from that. But still, there seems to be a right and a wrong way of deciding which of the universal generalizations, correct, true generalizations, to pick as one's laws.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to make a difference to how you. What you choose, which is then going to make a difference whether things go well for you or not.
Of course.
And I'm not seeing how that to make sense of that idea of a right and a wrong way when it's not at all empirically controlled.
Of course it's empirically controlled.
And I thought a choice of law isn't empirical. It's only empirical consequences of all of the regularities you believe in, not which of those regularities you take to be the laws.
Sorry, say that again, mate.
I thought what's empirically controlled is just which you take to be the correct universal generalizations, correct? Which amongst those you take to be the laws. I thought you said addition to say that this thing is a law doesn't itself have any empirical consequences.
It doesn't add anything to your, it certainly guides our beliefs about what will happen and so on from a restricted epistemic perspective. But you can separate the kind of modal content of a belief about laws from its implications for actuality. So you can separate, you know, its counterfactual implications from its implications for actuality. And there's always going to be a modal residue. That's just a point about the logic of law talk. So then the question is, well, what do those modal beliefs do? And my claim is, you can see the role that those modal beliefs play by seeing in the setting of a kind of agent with a kind of restricted epistemic and practical abilities, you can see the role that they play. And that's the whole story. And of course they are empirically controlled, and we have a whole battery of quite sophisticated cognitive and epistemic practices for arriving at modal beliefs. Of course they do, and there are good ones and there are bad ones.
I was just going to suggest something a little bit more specific you can say about in what respects one choice can be better than another. I mean, it seems to me that there are two respects which are worth distinguishing and which are kind of interesting because they pick up on things that other people have said about laws. One is, of course, if we choose to subscribe to different laws, it can turn out to be the case that one of us will come across a counterexample which isn't a counterexample for the other. So we'll have a case where one of the associated regularities turns out not to be true. But then the other thing is that there's another sense in which one of these kind of models consisting of laws can be better than another, in that it can have kind of greater generality. So it can kind of be something that we can apply in a range of cases where we can't apply the other one. And that's a notion of being better, which is kind of directly related to this predictive role of laws.
I'd be a little bit cautious about that, because I think a lot of the sort of quite specific high-level regularities that get embodied in models that have local applicability are much more powerful than the sort of, you know, perfectly general laws that we get from physics. So I think there's a trade-off between range of applicability and kind of power.
Okay, yeah, no, that's interesting. But, there's probably room for a kind of compromise there, where,
yeah,
where, you know, within some restricted domain, you still get this advantage of kind of sort of greater power within that restricted.
Right,
space.
So what you want is actually models that encode all of the regularities that hold across their range of applicability. So if you have a limited range of applicability, then there's probably going to be a lot more that will hold across that range, and you want a model that that will encode all of those regularities as laws that apply within that range of applicability. I mean, I think that's it's that trade-off between fixed and variable structure that sort of governs what gets encoded in our models.
Yeah, a very similar worry to Paul. So the question is, to what extent do the categorical facts constrain models that we sort of can build or should build? And so one view is that once all the categorical facts are in, sort of hypothetically, there is sort of just one model that probably fits them, because there are all these constraints that maybe generalities, so certainly all the regularities, have to be captured by, well, sorry, the other way around. Everything that the law says has to have no exceptions in the categorical facts, and maybe the chances have to roughly correspond to the frequencies. And so there are a lot of constraints posed by the categorical facts on a good model, and maybe generality and range of applicability and so on goes further. And if the constraints are so tight that basically there's just one right model or good model for this whole totality of facts, then I don't really see what what the real difference is to the reductionist view, which says, oh yeah, we can actually read off all the modal facts from the categorical facts in some not entirely obvious way, because we can read it off if there is this uniqueness. But if there's no uniqueness, then the puzzle arises, if there are sort of equally good laws that I could choose and you could choose, and there's nothing, sort of, it's not that mine are less general, there's no sort of general principle that would tell us why yours are better than mine would be a little bit wrong, then that seems to not capture something that is very important to our notion of
right, so the constraints that are active emerge, you know, when you're looking before all of the facts are in. And there's two ways in which, you know, that's true of us whenever, you know, we're forming models. There's only some facts that we ever know, and we're looking for patterns and regularities in those facts that then can be projected and parlayed into expectations about things that we don't already know. But there's also, you know, the fact that our own actions are never part of the models, that, you know, our own future actions are never part of the models that we're using. And, I mean, I think that's a deeper sort of point that explains why it is that our notions, that why it is that our models have modal content, not only because there's stuff that we don't know, so we're always partly guessing, but it's also because there's stuff that we can't know beforehand. I mean, you know, so there's a tendency to think, ah, yes, you know, people will imagine that, you know, once you kind of get rid of all of these contingent sort of restrictions on the knowledge that we actually have, you know, then what does you know, the modal force add? Well, you're looking at the degenerate context. We would never use or need modal beliefs, you know, if unless we had the kinds of practical and epistemic limitations that characterize the ordinary context for model building. So, I mean, I think maybe this will be helpful to go back to your question. Is, you know, we have all sorts of techniques for parlaying information about the past into expectations about the future, and those ones are just the ones that are canonized in, you know, the sort of patterns of scientific inference. And those, you know, those do pretty well, but they're by no means infallible, and you know, the world is a jungle red in tooth and claw. There's all kinds of expectations we form that, you know, that end up being undermined by the way things go, and we pick up the pieces and move on, and there's all kinds of kind of, you know, modal beliefs that we use as strategies for guiding decision that turn out to be, you know, sort of that undermine, that don't turn out to be sort of adaptive, and again, you know, we pick up the pieces and move on. So
it
might be right that laws and regularities differ in the way they connect with our decision making. As you said, you know, I can decide to produce an exception to irregularity, or I can decide to overturn irregularity, something that's merely been a hitherto regularity, and I can't decide to do something that's going to overturn a law.
I keep going back to Paul's question because I haven't satisfied him. So, but maybe this is a point at which I can say something useful. Beliefs about laws are different from beliefs about mere regularities.
Right.
So it's the kind of cognitive status of those things that, but when you call something a law, you then tell yourself, you kind of commit yourself practically to using it as a constraint on deliberation.
Okay, good. So we're talking about, so nevertheless, taking all that on board, there seem to be circumstances in which commitment to something being a law has nothing to do with anything that I could decide about. And, for instance, commitment to laws about, I don't know, the remote past, the distant future, the spatiotemporally distant, or whatever. So there will be a whole lot of commitments to laws that don't interact with decision. And conversely, there will be a whole lot of, well, what I was going to say, I don't know if what you just said undoes this, there's a whole lot of stuff about laws is not has nothing to do with laws. So I guess what one thing that bothers me about the pragmatic proposal that you're putting forward is not just what bothers me because I like metaphysics, and I, but also because when I think about how this view translates into our commitments to laws and regularities and so forth in the social domain, I can't help thinking, well, you know, if we were pragmatists, we would be guided. It can be pragmatically rewarding to treat all kinds of regularities as if they're laws. So, you know, there have been, as we know, the many people have treated regularities about women and philosophy as laws to keep women out of philosophy. They've treated, including women, they've treated regularities about certain social groups and racial groups as laws. And that can be very pragmatically useful, perhaps to the users, perhaps to others. Anyway, I feel like I'm now hand-waving a little bit, but the point is we can't simply have what are practically useful in guiding decision as all there is to the business of laws, because it's so remote from laws, and it can go be so pernicious in all sorts of bad ways. So obviously, okay, I know what's going to happen. You're going to say I'm completely misunderstanding what's going on, but the point is, it's going to be answerable to the reality is something that that our ambitions in describing the laws, it's got to live up to. So I'm still holding, so the realist view about laws is giving a criterion of answerability that is being left out by what you're saying. And I think that matters both in the social and political context as well as the scientific one that you're talking about. Anyway, I hope that gives some sense of my misgiving.
I feel I haven't conveyed sort of the view in the way that I would like to. I mean, I couldn't be more of a kind of scientific realist about laws and stuff. What I'm trying to deny here is, and I'm not talking about laws and so on in the social realm. I don't know, you know, what to say about those right now. But I think, you know, part of what my view about this is. God, I couldn't be more of an objectivist about, you know, kind of scientific laws, including the fundamental laws of temporal evolution and chances and stuff like that. What this is meant to do is free one from the burden of trying to say what it is in the world as it is, subspecie aeternitatis, that those things refer to. So when I say it's a sort of pragmatic view, I don't mean that your beliefs about those things should be governed by whatever pragmatic, you know, whatever you might find pragmatically useful. I'm rather trying to invert the question to say that, you know, that there's that sort of taking a pragmatic methodological stance on trying to understand the role that those beliefs play is where you're going to find in the cognitive life of the agent is where you're going to find, you know, an illuminating account of how they relate to reality. So, you know, again, the kinds of distinctions that someone that metaphysical, you know, kind of that was popular in the sort of neo-scholastic metaphysical tradition, not to impugn, was that those kinds of distinctions between, you know, beliefs that really reflect parts of the mind independent fabric of reality and ones that don't, those will now be drawn in the account of how different classes of beliefs get used. And there, instead of a simple dichotomy, there's beliefs that refer and beliefs that don't, you can have a quite rich differentiation of different types of use. And there's not, you know, the first class beliefs that really refer and the second class beliefs that don't. You've got a whole bunch of different uses, and beliefs about laws play a very important role in helping us, you know, sort of guide action, you know, being the kinds of creatures that we are, who are by our nature choosers, and who see the world as kind of rich with, who necessarily see the world
as rich with all kinds of affordances and opportunities. You can be right about what the affordances and opportunities are. You can be wrong about them. They're strictly kind of, you know, empirically controlled by all of the fact, you know, everything that we've learned in the past about you know, sort of what kinds of patterns are projectable and what ones aren't, what strategies pan out and which ones don't. I want to be a realist about all of that. All I want to do is suggest that the right way to understand that the you know, which pieces of belief, so to speak, reflect reality in that simple correspondence way, and which have them have a much more complex role, guided in part by beliefs about distributed structures and playing a role in you know, sort of identifying strategic routes to our ends, is much more complex.
I've got five people left on the list.
Sorry,
questions.
I'll be less long-winded.
No, then the question is short as well. But John's next.
Just
you don't want it. Okay. Toby.
I didn't understand. I'm sympathetic to the thought that you can't reduce chances and laws to frequencies or regularities, but I didn't really understand the Maudlin argument you had when you said any stipulation you like, there's a model where there are chances that I'm in stipulation. That just seemed like begging the question. What if I stipulate chances are frequencies? Then how can there be a model where the chances fail to be frequencies?
We'll think about Bernoulli's theorem, right? It's still possible. I mean, I take that to be definitive of the notion of chance that Bernoulli's theorem holds for, that it satisfies the axioms of probability. So there's always, no matter if you're talking about probabilities, no matter what you say the frequencies are, there's always a non-zero probability that the chances will diverge arbitrarily far from the frequencies. I take that to be part of the logic of chance talk. And essential to the function that beliefs about chance play in guiding belief.
James.
Thanks. So the kind of laws that seem most amenable or that seem to be the kind of direct target of your analysis would be laws that are closely related to regularities. So you know, there's a regularity that all f to g is, and then we want to know why for some of those regularities do we kind of have necessarily all f to g's. So I was thinking about kind of two kinds of case which would seem to be kind of potentially difficult to review and interested to know what thoughts you have about them. Okay, so one case would be I think alluded to by well, the same as what Ray said. It's hard to see how laws about what happens beyond the event horizon of a black hole could even in principle be relevant to practical deliberation. So, and more generally, you know, one might think that a lot of stuff about the large scale structure of the universe or laws of cosmology just they're not even possibly relevant to practical deliberation.
Can I say something that I should have said
when
Ray was talking? There's a tendency also to jump, you know, that kind of lunge that people make for the degenerate case when they're trying to understand things about, you know, the function of beliefs about laws and so on. I can't point to a function that beliefs about laws and about laws of cosmology play in my own individual life. I can kind of step back and understand why there's a practice, a kind of collective practice of, you know, trying to, as it were, unearth the modal substructure of the universe at the local scale. You know, and I can understand the sort of process by which we kind of look for increasingly encompassing models, and I can see how that practice runs to ultimately a fully encompassing model of the universe as a whole. And in fact, for some of the reasons that you yourself have given, there is a use for the sort of a deep, you know, a kind of fundamental model that will embed all of the local models whose use we can connect much more closely
to kind of local practice and interaction with the environment, and it's something more like a unifying role that will render them all commensurate and show how they bear on one another. So I can understand that wider practice of which, you know, sort of looking for universal laws play a role, but I think the local sites of application are the more limited local models that do have a much more direct role in our interaction with the environment. And that, you know, just as a comment about cosmology, I actually don't think that things like laws that are defined only for universes as whole make sense, except in a sort of, you know, metaphorical way that we think of God as choosing, you know, one among all sets of all possible worlds. I can understand cosmological laws as kind of global extrapolations of local laws that we can test and so on. But laws that are defined only for the universe as a whole, or likewise probability distributions, a probability distribution only over worlds as wholes, I can't understand those except as extrapolations from the local case where, you know, where they do have empirical content and or can be connected in some more attenuated way to processes that do have a kind of local empirical and practical application.
Okay, good. So very quickly, my second kind of problem case was going to be high-level symmetry principles, where now it's difficult to say, as you said, that the empirical content of the law is exhausted by the regularity, because
yes.
There is no direct regularity
that
corresponds to Lorentz invariance or conservation.
Okay, so those cases I think are extremely interesting because, especially with symmetry, I think what symmetry does there. So I do think that there is a very purpose and practical role for having a fundamental model, one into which, you know, all of the other kind of more local high level models can be embedded. And I think that one of the ways in which we sort of arrive at a fundamental model is by identifying and teasing out excess structure in these high-level models. And things like symmetry and other kind of formal criteria for identifying redundancy can be a really, really good guide, one that's proven historically in physics to be a really quite powerful way of getting rid of excess structures. If you look back over the history and this is something that we found. I mean, it's not something that kind of a priori, except in retrospect, we can see the role that it was playing. And other kinds of aesthetic criteria, I think, have the same kind of post hoc. We can see that you know, if you can identify a symmetry, often what the symmetry is signaling is some sort of redundancy in the representational apparatus, and then you can use that to eliminate and come up with a more fundamental model that doesn't have that symmetry, and, you know, that gets rid of the redundancy, and that turns out to be predictively better, a better theory in all sorts of ways.
Amy.
Yeah, I thought that was great. I really liked the view a lot. I just wanted to put to you the kind of question that gets put to me in my point of sort of similar views, but kind of different part of the topic. If I understood you right, part of what you want to say is that in calling a law as opposed to mere regularity is committing to using it as a sort of constraint on deliberation and action in many ways. So what do you say about the embedding problem, about cases in which we say, you know, that T is a law, but embedded in a hypothetical, which seems to be explicitly disconnecting it from our action deliberation? So if P is a law, then we shouldn't do Q or something.
Well, so things like that happen all the time in science. And I take it to be imaginative exploration of the consequences of, you know, adopting certain sorts of beliefs about the world. So, for example, you know, people will often say, "Look, if the fundamental constants have had slightly different values, then so and so." It's just kind of imaginatively drawing out the consequences of certain hypothetical presumptions.
Did I miss the meaning of the claim that P is a law as being the same in the embedded context and the unembedded context, or in the embedded context, it's the same thing as a regularity?
Say that again.
So you've got the claim that P is a law, right? When you embed this in the hypothetical context, if it's the case that P is a law, right? Does that P is a law have the same meaning as it does when you
the first order sort of, these all have an ordinary kind of truth conditional logic. So, you know, when you say that P is a law, you suppose that it has certain kinds of implications both for actuality and for counterfactuality. And when you say if P were a law, then you're kind of conditionally endorsing those implications. So, for example, people will in science say, well, look, if the laws of thermodynamics really were laws, and we don't think they are, right, then it would be impossible for there ever to be an entropy decreasing process. Right? That's just sort of drawing out the logical, you know, and truth conditional implications of the supposition that they were in fact laws.
Alice.
There are causal facts, there are facts about laws, there are modal facts, end of story, they're not reducible to anything else.
So primitivism.
Yeah. But not the kind of primitivism that suggests that when I look at the world subspeciator natatis, there's something that they correspond to. I'm not sure that those are at all incompatible. I mean, and to say that, you know, we start out with certain goals and then we create models in order to solve, you know, to facilitate achieving those goals, or we have certain problems, and that's the wrong way to put it. I mean, we are by our nature choosers. You know, all of our cognitive apparatus is sort of from a naturalistic perspective there to facilitate. It's a sort of layer of representational mediation between stimulus and response that creates the context of thought at all. You know, so by the time we're thinking, we're already seeing the world, or representing the world, or understanding the world in terms of opportunities and affordances for us for action, and sort of it's all already there. And I also think that it is probably true of us that you know, the sort of natural curiosity is part of what's allowed us to survive, the attempt to know more about the world and to, you know, to build richer and wider models and to use those. That's part of what we are. That's part of, you know, what makes us the kinds of beings that we are. So it's not the case that, yes, but, you know, some of those, you know, sometimes when we're doing that, it doesn't really have a purpose. It's like, well, you know, it's never a conscious end of ours, you know, to build the model in order to satisfy goals. So that's the kind of creature we are, and it's proven to be
Part of what allows us to have the kind, you know, soft pink creatures that we are, so the kind is part of what's allowed us to survive in a jungle of red and tooth and claw.
Well, I think we'll stop there and say thanks to Jeanette.